I'm Dan Gottlieb. Thanks for listening to Voices in the Family. It's 11 hours, 53 minutes, and 45 seconds until November 6th, Election Day. As we tick towards the big day, the Voices in the Family staff has all kinds of questions about the men and women who run for public office. We wonder, do they share certain personality traits? Why do they enter the political arena in the first place? And what toll does campaigning take on them, personally and their families? There must be enormous stress and strain, and it's a wonder why anyone wants to become the focus of public attention. Well, let's set the stage for our conversation with the story of Sam Katz. Remember him? Successful Philadelphia businessman, husband and father, he campaigned unsuccessfully for mayor of Philadelphia three times between 1991 and 2003. He also ran for governor of Pennsylvania to no avail. Mike and Scott sat down with Katz, who offers this candid take on his political past, beginning with his second run for mayor.
2003 was a slugfest and a very nasty affair. And the physical demands of that campaign, having to raise money every day, having to be sharp, having to avoid mistakes, that was very demanding.
What kinds of conversations did you have with your family in terms of what toll it would take on your family?
You try to treat it as if it's just another thing that I'm doing. And I've done a lot of interesting things and a lot of crazy things. So my family was pretty used to the fact that I was not on a conservative career path, that I was doing things that were off the beaten track. And that to the greatest extent that we could, to involve them and to not make this a big deal. The big problems arise with the scheduling conflicts when, you know, the night of the prom. And, you know, I couldn't be at the pre-prom party. So I showed up at the prom, which did not make my daughter happy. She came right across the room at the Horticultural Center the night of her prom. This is my youngest daughter, Elizabeth. What are you doing here, Dad? So I would try to compensate for these losses and misses that came about. But, you know, it's very difficult for children, especially television advertising that was pretty bad and pretty rough. You know, you hear things about your father. You would like to think they're not true, but you probably can't be sure. I'm sure there were some mean things said to them in school, that kids would say things, especially for a father who's lost four times.
What were your own emotions, especially during the 2003 campaign when things got very nasty, got very personal? What would you feel like when you would hear these ads or read something in the paper?
In 2003, it wasn't the ads or the paper, it was the in-your-face. One of the unions had four or five full-time people whose job it was to be in my face and be in my family's face, including the kids on occasion. And that angered me. I wouldn't characterize myself as a kid growing up in Philadelphia as a street fighter. I wasn't. But I wanted a street fight. And there was a night under I-95 in which we had a rally for our South Philadelphia supporters that was drowned out by the presence of some pretty rough characters. And I was furious. I was out of control furious. And I had to be dragged into the car because I wanted everybody. I wanted a piece of everybody. I was so angry. I don't think I realized how beat up I was in that process until it was over and somebody made a movie about it and I got to watch the movie. And that was a little rough. But my own emotions in a campaign is like life. You have great days and you have terrible days, moments of great optimism and moments when you can't drag yourself out of bed. And over the course of these four political campaigns that I had, there were plenty of moments when I didn't want to get out of bed, when I wanted to quit, when quitting seemed like the right thing for me. But then I would get up and put one foot in front of the other and show up where I had to be and make the next call for fundraising. And something would happen and it would spark, you know, some enthusiasm. And by the end of the day, I had my stride.
You were a businessman before you decided to run for office. So I'm sure you had adversity and tough moments all along. Did you misjudge how thick a skin you would need to run for office, just how nasty things would get?
Well, I think that's a good question. I don't think I knew how tough my skin could be. But after each campaign, I seemed to shed that skin, and then I'd have to develop it again. I look at the campaigns of Sam Katz as it's like, who is that guy? Well, where did he come from? Because that guy and this guy today seem to me to be very different people. And I don't know where that came from. And I wonder whether I could summon it again. I hope I could if I ever had the desire or the decision to do it.
Can you describe the impact of losing, especially in your last campaign where things were, the stakes were very high, things were really close? What was that day like after the election?
That was the 2003 campaign, the 2003 election, and the weeks and months afterwards were depressing. And I was a pretty depressed person. I went into a shell. I had made a very stupid decision to borrow a lot of money to fund an Election Day operation, which I did not have in 1999. I had to personally sign for it, figuring, well, I'm either going to win and pay it off, or I'm going to lose and raise it because I'll, you know, be close. I got shellacked. I think I lost by 15 or 16 points. And then I didn't want to raise money. I didn't want to talk to anybody. So I was in a double whammy. I was in a bad place emotionally and psychologically, and I was in a bad place financially. I didn't have a business to come back to. I had moved from my business to run again. I had no equilibrium. I was, you know, I had said, I had spent a very significant part of my adult life aspiring to hold a job which most people thought I was crazy to want, and that I had finally affirmed unequivocally that I was never going to get it. Well, if you express that to yourself the way I just did, it's the F word that comes to mind, failure. And so I carried myself through most of 2004 and well into 2005 and maybe beyond feeling that way. And as I began to work myself out of that and began to reassess, you know, what was happening and how unimportant all that really was and what else I could do with my life that would be fun and meaningful, you know, I climbed out of it. But it was a very, very disappointing 12-year crusade, if you will.
That was Philadelphia businessman and three-time mayoral candidate Sam Katz speaking with Mike and Scott. And by the way, Katz now makes documentary films about the city's history. Well, this is Voices in the Family, and on today's show, we're asking the question, who's attracted to public service and why? What's at stake for them and their families on a personal level? What happens when they win? What happens when they lose? Well, here with me to help sort out some of these questions are Drs. Lisa Cohen and Ashley Weinberg. Ashley Weinberg's the author of The Psychology of Politicians. He's a psychologist, senior lecturer, fellow at the University of Salford in Manchester. And he joins us from across the pond. Ashley Weinberg, welcome
Hello.
To the show.
Well, thank you very much indeed for having me on the show. It's a great honor to be here.
Yeah, it sure is. It sure is. It's the moment, isn't it?
Well, it doesn't get more exciting or closer, I suspect, in the history of U.S. presidential elections and all the other elections that are going on as well.
Well, we'll talk about that as the show moves on. I want to introduce also Dr. Lisa Cohen, who's a psychologist who works as a teacher, scientist, and a clinician. She's an associate professor of clinical psychology at Beth Israel Medical Center, Einstein College of Medicine in New York City. And she's written the Handy Psychology Answer Book and is a self-described political junkie. Lisa, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. I'm very happy to be here.
I'm sure you're very happy to be anywhere after living in Manhattan and getting through Sandy.
Well, I'm very happy to have lights.
Yeah.
So today I have lights in my office. Last week we were going on daylight,
yeah,
which works fine when there's sun, but not when there isn't.
Well, that's the good news about trauma. You're so grateful for the little things.
That is true.
And we'd love to hear from you, our callers, and our number is 888-477-9499. We are talking about the psychology of politicians, and we're talking about the psychology of the electorate, but we are not here to promote one politician over the other. But we'd love to hear from you. 888-477-9499. Ashley, let's start with you. We heard some interesting things just now from Sam Katz, but let's talk about what actually serving in the public sphere does to someone, the good news and the bad news. I'm sure the good news is a sense of satisfaction at helping others. But I also wonder, you know, you get at these higher levels, you lose real relationships, you know, with people.
Yeah, I think that's a potential danger of this kind of occupation, I guess. And I suppose underpinning this is a tendency to forget sometimes that politicians are, just like the rest of us, human beings, and that relationships are, you know, of paramount importance. It's not surprising after elections we've had over here a couple of years ago with members of parliament being elected that quite a few who were doing the job for the first time really recognised the toll which they hadn't anticipated on their personal lives, which obviously impacted on their psychological and physical health as well in some cases. So it's a shame. I suppose we'll always tend to focus on the negatives, but you're quite right to kick off with the positives. There really is, if you ask politicians, a sense that they want to make a change, they want to make a difference in a positive kind of way, as well as, I suppose, for themselves, a sense of fulfillment, and that being at the centre of things is actually quite an attractive thing. And I suppose that's where the idea of the power, politics is about power, sort of comes into it. But at the same time, you're quite right, it's that duality of being an individual but also serving in a greater role.
Mm. You said elsewhere that the stress of holding office is even more stressful than campaigning, which we don't usually think about.
Well, yes, I mean, I suppose it depends a little bit on at what point you ask politicians about how they're feeling and how they've been. But again, sort of more than one study I've conducted with politicians over here in the UK seems to show that levels of psychological strain, and we use sort of standardized measures each time, seem to be higher 6 months after they've begun the job for the first time than it was, you know, in the month running up to it when they were in the middle of their campaigning. I mean, you could say there are a range of reasons for that, and any of us in a new job will try to, you know, have to adapt to things, and sometimes we'll do that successfully and sometimes less successfully. And after a year or so, I suppose politicians, like others, settle into that role okay. But there still seems to be a toll in terms of physical stress, which I think is something to do with the very long hours. And again, this isn't just about politicians. I suspect in the media you know all about these things, and in many of your listeners' working lives and non-working lives as well, the high levels of demand for long periods of time. And that obviously does take a toll as well.
There's a different quality, though, of you're not just talking about long hours and demanding hours. That's bad enough. But there's a scrutiny, a public scrutiny, which adds a whole other layer of stress.
Well, absolutely. I mean, there aren't many jobs, I suppose, where you may have several thousand people's needs to deal with, the demands of your own political party, perhaps the local activists group as well, nationally, a role to play in your own parliament, dealing with a whole range of different issues. It's an all-encompassing job. So, yes, qualitatively, you're absolutely right, as well as quantitatively, it's a very demanding job indeed.
Lisa, let's come back for a minute to the Sam Katz interview. I'm curious about what happens with people who lose. Sam said that he was depressed. He lost his what he said was thick skin. Is that typical? Do people, I hate to use the word typical, but is that common for people to get depressed after they lose?
Well, I think we have heard about other politicians getting depressed after they lose, but I think there are two things to consider here. One is there's a certain letdown that happens after you've been spending 20 hours a day putting all of your energy and all of your focus into a particular goal, and there's so much emotion associated with it. You're kind of having to be on a high. The adrenaline has to be really flowing. People really have to be almost hypomanic in order to run a successful campaign. And when that gets removed and there's no follow-up, it's not surprising that there would be a crash. It's sort of like actors whose show ends, you know, the morning after is a real letdown. So I think that's part of it. But I think you also have to question what it meant to him to win and why he was running in the first place. So, you know, I only had a little bit of information to go on, but it did seem to be that his identity was very, very wrapped up into this goal of becoming a public official, of becoming an elected official.
Isn't that typical?
I think there needs to be more research on this, and that's why I'm glad that Ashley Weinberg is doing his research, because it's really important work. I mean, we're all entirely dependent on the choices and behaviors of politicians, and psychology has not done, I don't think, enough research to understand what really happens. But certainly what research has been done has shown that issues of narcissism do tend to be elevated with people seeking political office, that they're looking for status, they're looking for power, they're looking for validation and recognition by very, very large amounts of people.
All right. Well, let me stop you there with that word, because that's what we hear when we think of politicians, is that they are narcissistic, and we throw that word around. What does it really mean? I mean, you mentioned insecurity. Is that part of narcissism, or politicians underneath it all insecure, or perhaps too secure?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, again, I think these are really important questions that need to be really thought through more. The way I look at it is you can look at narcissism on a spectrum, from healthy narcissism all the way to kind of psychopathic and malevolent narcissism. And healthy narcissism is people with a strong sense of self, with strong self-esteem. They're confident. They're resilient. They have a healthy sense of entitlement. Not that they feel the world owes them a living, but they feel they're part of society and they deserve to participate in its fruits. And then if that healthy self-esteem continues to grow, it can get out of proportion, and it can start to dominate a sense of being part of the group, of being part of society with others, and they really see themselves as above the crowd, as better than, as deserving more.
And we see that so often with politicians, and that's where things go downhill.
And that's where things go downhill. Now, it's not to say that all narcissism is bad. I mean, I think you have to have a pretty good dose of it to be able to run a campaign, to be able to tolerate people saying horrible things about you, to be able to tolerate the average. You really have to have that drive. You have to have that resiliency, and you have to have that energy. So some degree of it, I think, is a necessary part of leadership. But I think that it can get out of hand. It can get disproportionate, and that's when we really run into trouble. And also the nature, it's not only the personality traits that the person brings to the job and that attracts them to the job, it's the circumstances they encounter. So yes, they're under a lot of stress, but if they're successful, they're surrounded by cheering throngs, and they're likely to be surrounded by sycophants.
Well, and that's kind of what I mentioned to Ashley about the loss of very real relationships. Ashley, I want to turn to you quickly before we have to take a break. And one of your observations is that politicians tend to be more extroverted and emotionally stable than the rest of the population. But as at its extremes, emotional stability could mean absence of palpable emotions.
Well, that's a very interesting question, isn't it? And I mean, certainly there are studies that show, mainly from Italy, I have to say, but some from looking at presidents in the States, but also in Greece as well, that some personality traits seem to stand out more in politicians than they do in the rest of the voting public. And I suppose there is that worry about an emotional distance from the people you're dealing with, but I think that's probably to some extent the same in many, many jobs where people are holding high levels of responsibility, whether it's in healthcare or teaching or law enforcement, whatever it might be. I suppose with politicians, obviously, it's magnified to a much greater degree because of the media scrutiny that you already mentioned. So whether it's an unhealthy detachment or not, I think it's interesting to hear Lisa talk about that continuum. And I was just thinking about my own narcissistic levels, you know, being here on a radio program across the Atlantic, and just being careful about how I should be feeling at this point in time, to be honest.
You are tempting this clinical interviewer here. You're tempting me to begin to explore how you're feeling, but I'm going to be a good boy here, and my producers are watching me vigilantly across the screen. So I'll be good. We've got to take a very short break, just 60 seconds, and we'll come back. There's a lot of other issues we want to cover, especially why do they get into it in the first place? We're talking about the psychology of politics, of politicians. What makes them get into it? What's the impact on their lives once they win and once they lose? We're talking with Lisa Cohen and Ashley Weinberg. Weinberg is the author of Psychology of Politicians, and he's at the University of Salford in Manchester. Lisa Cohen is a psychologist, associate professor of clinical psychiatry at Beth Israel Medical Center in New York City. And she's written the Handy Psychology Answer Book. Our number is 888-477-9499. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family right here on WHYY-FM.
Devereaux supports WHYY, a national behavioral healthcare organization founded and headquartered in Philadelphia. Devereaux is celebrating its 100th anniversary of providing innovative care for individuals with behavioral challenges, mental health illness, and developmental disabilities. Founded in 1912 by Philadelphia schoolteacher Helena Devereaux, the organization was developed to provide help to children and adults with special needs. Find more information about Devereaux and its centennial anniversary at 610-542-3041 or online at devereaux.org.
University of the Sciences in Philadelphia supports WHYY. Whether you're a college-bound senior or are thinking of transferring, you'll have questions ranging from what are classes like, to what activities can I do, to where will this lead my career? To help students with their questions, USciences is holding a series of on-campus open houses. Prospective students are invited to tour the campus, talk to students, faculty, and staff, and learn about the admission and financial aid process. Open house details at usciences.edu/openhouse.
We are back on Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the psychology of politicians with psychologists, Drs. Lisa Cohen and Ashley Weinberg. We have on the phone Sarah Earlbaum. She's a township supervisor in White Marsh Township in Montgomery County. And she's been listening to the show. I hope you've been listening to the show. Sarah, do we have you?
Hi. Yes, Dan. It's Sarah.
Hi, Sarah. So you're in your second term as supervisor. Tell us why you got involved in your community at that level.
Actually, I got involved because there were some people, I had done some other volunteer work, and people encouraged me actually to run for office. And I guess, following on what Dr. Weinberg just said, that, you know, I really got into it to do good things for my community. I thought about my background and some of the issues facing my township, and I really wanted to be a part of finding some solutions and working with residents and working with staff at the township to really make life better here in a place where I'm living myself and raising my children.
How was election for you at that level? Campaigning?
It was very interesting to me. I'm not a big politico. I love to vote. I love to do things, but I wasn't one of those people that was really involved in politics before I ran. And it really was an eye-opener to me. Actually, in my second time I ran, there was a lot of sort of bad press going out there. The opposition actually sent a flyer out, a mailing to the entire township, telling basically lies about me. They said that I was involved in a certain case, and that I knew people and I was trying to, you know, maneuver things, and I didn't even know the people who were involved in the case at all. And this went all over, you know, the township, which for me was really difficult, I guess, at the level for my children. I knew that, you know, my children knew these people. You know, it's a community, so we know each other. And I really had to have a sit down with my kids to talk to them about, you know, when things happen like this, you know, you're responsible for how you react back. You can't help what people put out there. But at least for me, I said, you know, I know what my truth is. And, you know, that's where I can stand.
How old were your kids?
My kids at the time were 6 and 8. When I ran the first time, it was, you know, 4 years earlier. They were 2 and 4.
How's your job? How do you like it?
I love serving. I absolutely love serving the residents. It is stressful at times in the sense that I think people assume we're in it for the power or we have more power than we actually have. Obviously, even with the recent storms, there were a lot of power outages in the township. There were a lot of trees down. And staff was doing everything that they could, but there was a lot of things that were out of our hands as a township. They had to go to the electric companies and other, you know, entities. And people would, you know, call and email with a lot of vitriol, very, very upset that we weren't doing something when we were actually coordinating as best we could. And we were in charge and talking to the people that we could talk to, but it was out of our control in a lot of ways.
Well, yeah, you had to deal with their anger and your helplessness, really.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's a difficult position. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us and for the work you do.
Well, thank you. And I really think this is an important topic, so I'm glad you're discussing it today. Thank you very much.
Yeah, me too. Me too. Lisa, did you have any thoughts about what you heard about her reaction? I was thinking about that thick skin thing that Sam Katz talked about that didn't sound like Sarah had.
Well, it certainly is part of what any politician in electoral office has to deal with, that campaigns can get very, very vicious, and part of it is the way that people make up their mind when they vote. We would like to think that these are reasoned, rational discourses, but the truth is, and everyone in advertising knows this, that people's decisions are in large part emotional. So campaigns deal with emotional slurs and they make emotional attacks. And so part of the business is to find some way to build some resilience to that. Now, if you go into office and you really want to help people, I can imagine it's very, very frustrating because part of your identity is that you want to be a nice person, you want to help, and yet you're getting accused of all sorts of heinous things that never occurred to you before. And if you have a family, of course, they're exposed to that. It seems to me it would be really necessary in a situation like that and in any similar situation to make sure that you have a really good support system. And to make sure that there are people in your corner who can really back you up and support you. And I think politicians do tend to do that. As they get in greater positions of power, however, what we have seen is sometimes they get in a bit of a bubble because they're protecting themselves from kind of an unsafe, hostile world, and they get too cut off. And then they don't have open communication between themselves and the outside world. But another thing she said that I think was really, really important, and this is what she said to her children, is you need to focus on what you can control and what you can't, and that you really can't control what people say about you. You have to focus on what you can control, how you respond, what you do about it, and how you see yourself.
Yeah, the Niebauer's Serenity Prayer kind of works in so many places. Let's go back to the phone lines. We've got Herb on the line. Hi, Herb. Herb?
Yes, hello?
Yes.
Hi, my phone connection just got very choppy.
Well.
Do you have me still?
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, good. I couldn't hear you. All right, fine. I grew up through my teen years as one of four children in a household where both my mother and father were elected officials. My mother was serving in the state senate. My father was county executive for a time. And that was on the one hand, a very fascinating, exciting way to grow up. We met all sorts of people and had many experiences that were wonderful and some kind of strange. My father used to joke that it was a case of politics making strange bedfellows in our family. That said, then, there was also a downside of it. And I want to stress that in the 1960s, in the campaigns that I experienced and worked actively in, I never saw the kind of negativity directed even at the candidates, much less at families, that I see today. That said, when one of the children had an incident involving the campus police, it made the front page of the local paper under a headline that said, you know, public official's son involved in scuffle with campus police. And I would contend that that headline and front page placement of such a story would never have happened with almost any other student at the college in that time, that it was strictly because of the parent's position. So what your guest was just saying about how we have to learn as family members, it's that it's how you react to these things, it's not the accusations themselves, how important that is absolutely true. Because whether it's a mistake that the child makes or an accusation that the child hears, some of it is very bitter to handle when one is living through it, even though much of it was absolutely thrilling, exciting, and sometimes highly comical in the sense that we would see people so infatuated with their own self-importance over what were relatively lower-level government positions that became almost Fellini-esque to someone who could appreciate the irony of the situation.
Well,
so that's my comment.
How fortunate you were that you had a family that could appreciate the irony. Herb, thanks so much for your call. Boy, do you have a unique perspective on this. Ashley Weinberg, I'm curious about your take on something specific that Herb said at the beginning about the vitriol that wasn't there in the 60s that is there now. What is that about?
Well, I wonder if part of it is something akin to a fascination we tend to have. I don't know whether that's something on both sides of the Atlantic, with soap operas, with human emotions and seeing them played out in front of us, almost like the Roman amphitheater of old, where we can see these things going on and feel a sense of detachment from it and almost always there for our own entertainment. And perhaps that's something to do, and I'm sure you'll tell me different if I'm wrong, with the way that the media is able to work in different quarters and the influence it feels it may exert, but also something to do with, I think, that idea of control that a couple of people have already hit upon, where how much control can you have over things as a politician, as a member of a politician's family, or as someone who wants to go into this field. And people in politics find surprisingly low levels of control, which the rest of the public won't necessarily appreciate and won't really believe, I think. And so having some level of control over the emotions that are going on is a very difficult thing to achieve.
Well, I wonder if politicians themselves can acknowledge that. There was one point in the debate. I don't know if you heard this. I forget which debate. It might have been the second debate where someone asked, what can a president do to lower gas prices? And neither one of them really answered. You know, they both talked about down the pike and cut down on. But the real answer is not much, you know?
But
neither one of them could say that or acknowledge it, even maybe to themselves.
Exactly, and that's a difficulty again with being a politician. You know that people need to see you exerting a level of control, a level of leadership, which is one of the reasons why people will or won't vote for you. Mm. So it's a very hard thing for a politician to say, I'm sorry, there's not much I can do about that. It's very quickly a self-defeating line. So it's surprising when you ask politicians and perhaps get them to scribble it down on an anonymous measure, you know, how much control do you feel you have over your job? It's actually a lot less than many of us feel in our own jobs, which is, in one sense, surprising, and perhaps on another sense, given the seriousness of the issues, a bit horrifying as well.
Yeah, exactly. I want to play a piece of an interview that we did last week. A fascinating guy, Stanley Renshaw, is a professor of political science at City University of New York. He's published a lot of books and articles around presidential politics and leadership. He's studied personality patterns of President Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, most recently Barack Obama. I believe he's published books on all of them. Well, he couldn't join us live today, but producer Jennifer Lynn caught up to him, and she dialed him up for a brief conversation last week while he was vacationing in California.
I hear this phrase all the time. People will say, oh, I'm such a political junkie. I kind of see you as a political psychological junkie. Would you agree?
When I'm working, generally, I can spend 4 and 5 hours a day on this material easily. I mean, that would be a quiet day for me. And if you immerse yourself in somebody's life who's going to be a president, you get to know a fair amount about them over 2.5 or 3 years. And I've had the opportunity to, people have said to me, would you like me to check around and see if we could get you an introduction to this person or that person who knows the president, and maybe you could get to the president. But my work doesn't operate that way, primarily because there's not much that you could ask a presidential candidate in the space of 20 minutes that would give you any particular insight into their psychology or the patterns. These are people who are, you know, they've done a zillion interviews, and it would be totally rude and inappropriate to say, well, to Barack Obama, I noticed, you know, in your high school yearbook, you didn't acknowledge your mother at all. Mm-hmm. Would that be because you felt abandoned by her?
That's really funny. Well, you mentioned in the Montreal Review that both candidates running for president had two different psychologies. How would you describe each briefly?
Oh, well, my point was that since almost every presidential candidate has these very high levels of ambition, it really doesn't distinguish an Obama from a Romney. It doesn't a Bush from another Bush or a Clinton. They all operate at that very high level. But I think there's some traction to be had by looking at the purposes to which they put their ambition. And so we ask, why do they want that power? Why do they want the presidency? What will they do with it? And for Obama, it was pretty clear. It was, you know, pretty clear early on that he wanted to be a transformational president. He wanted to be a great president. He has equated several times the idea of changing the culture of the country, and that's what would make a great president. And so he did want to be a transformational president and change the culture of the country and so forth. And so for him, historical greatness is really the key to his ambition. And for Romney, Romney doesn't want to be a historical figure. I doubt, you know, if you asked Romney about, you know, Mount Rushmore, he would laugh at you, and it probably doesn't even occur to him in his wildest dreams that that's where he might wind up. What he wants to do is save the country and the culture that he loves. And so he doesn't want to transform the culture. He wants to say that he sees the culture as being essentially in a lot of trouble. And so that's a very different level. He wants to reform the country, not transform it. And so that's a pretty sharp difference between the two presidential candidates.
That was Jennifer Lynn speaking with New York psychoanalyst Stanley Renshaw about personalities of presidents, and that's what we're talking about. We're talking about the psychology of politicians. We're going to take a short break. When we do, we're going to talk about the psychology of the electorate. We're talking with psychologists Ashley Weinberg and Lisa Cohen. Weinberg is the author of The Psychology of Politicians, and he's at the University of Salford in Manchester. Lisa Cohen is an associate professor of clinical psychiatry at Beth Israel Medical Center in New York City. Well, I'm Dan Gottlieb. You're listening to Voices in the Family. It's right here on WHYY-FM.
The Philadelphia Foundation supports WHYY. The Philadelphia Foundation works to advance economic opportunity in southeastern Pennsylvania. It helps strengthen nonprofits that develop workplace skills, teach financial literacy, help new arrivals, and sustain those undergoing tough times. The Foundation can help you make a difference for such nonprofits today and forever. The Philadelphia Foundation, 215-563-6417 or philafound.org.
I'm Dave Davies. Join me next for a WHYY original production, Beyond the Ballot. On the eve of the election, we'll consider Mitt Romney's chances of an upset in Pennsylvania and whether tales of Philadelphia voter fraud are real or imagined. We'll look at a spirited Senate race in Delaware, meet a real-life member of the Electoral College, and get a British perspective on the American political circus. That's Beyond the Ballot, next on WHYY-FM.
Welcome back to Voices in the Family. I'm Dan Gottlieb, your host. We're talking about the psychology of politicians, and we're doing it with psychologists Lisa Cohen and Ashley Weinberg, and I know they're probably chomping at the bit to respond to the interview with Stanley Renshaw. I'm going to ask you guys to hold on for just a second because I want to introduce you guys to someone new. Helen Fisher we have on the phone. She's a biological anthropologist from Rutgers University and chief scientific advisor to chemistry.com. She recently penned an article called What's in a Politician's Brain? Obama, Romney, and the Genetics of Power. And we just picked it up. It's in this week's edition of Newsweek. Helen Fisher.
Yes.
Interesting take. You talk about four brain systems, but it's actually four hormonal systems in the brain.
Well, two are hormonal and really two are transmitter systems. I think we've come, I do study the brain, and I think we've evolved four very broad styles of thinking and behaving, four constellations of personality traits linked with the dopamine, serotonin, testosterone, and estrogen systems. So we're all a mix of all of them, of course, but we do have personalities. So I created a questionnaire to measure the degree to which you express the traits linked with each of these four systems. And then I put it on the internationalmatch.com site and domestically on the chemistry.com site. And now 12 million people have taken it, or a little more than that, actually, in 40 countries. So basically, for months I've been studying Romney and Obama and looking at the traits, the way they express themselves, the words they choose, the way the face is built, testosterone builds the face in certain ways. And I've sort of, they're very different men, biologically. They're very different men.
I want to, before you get into details, I want to make sure that you didn't get this information because both of them are on Match.com. I don't want to start an explosive media thing going on.
No.
Okay.
You know, Match.com came to me in 2005 and asked me, why do you fall in love with one person rather than another? And at the time I said, I don't know. I mean, nobody knows. And there's two parts of personality. There's basically your culture, everything you grew up to believe and do and say and think. And there's your biology.
So tell me about their biology. What's your assessment?
Well, when I take a look at them very carefully, they both express a lot of the traits of the testosterone system, and they're both analytical, competitive, strategic, exacting, data-driven. But Romney expresses many more of some of the other traits linked with testosterone. Linked with testosterone is a heightened sensitivity to rank. I mean, you inject testosterone into a monkey or a bird, and in fact, they will often fight for rank. And you can see, if you read Romney's book, No Apology, he wants America to be number one. He does not somehow embrace the concept of a balance of world powers, and I think that's a part of the testosterone system. He also, Americans wonder whether he's empathetic. He may be very empathetic, but elevated activity in the testosterone system is linked biologically with less compassion. So in many respects, he expresses more of the traits linked with testosterone. Obama expresses more of the traits linked with estrogen as well as testosterone. I mean, there's a lot of football players who have a lot of estrogen as well as testosterone, but Obama tends to see the big picture. He's got verbal skills and people skills. He's displayed compassion ever since he began his career of going door-to-door in Chicago to help the poor. So basically, they express, you know, different degrees of the testosterone and estrogen system, but they also express different degrees of the serotonin and dopamine system. One example is we've done some fMRI studies of serotonin and elevated activity in the brain. And anyway, those people who are very expressive of serotonin tend to be what academics call social norm conformity. And that Romney follows the rules. He respects authority. He's orderly. He's religious. And all of those traits are linked with the serotonin system, whereas with Obama, he's a daring man. He's a curious and creative man that's linked with dopamine. And I think that daring really came out with the bin Laden issue. You know, all but one of his advisors told him not to raid bin Laden's compound, and he did it anyway. People who are very expressive of the dopamine system can lose big, and they can win big.
I want to comment on this issue of testosterone, and I want to ask Lisa Cohen and Ashley Weinberg to weigh in on it, and. When I heard Helen talking about testosterone, I flashed to Hillary Clinton in 2008, and there was a point in which she began to cry out of frustration. It's all over the media, and it really harmed her campaign tremendously. So What are we looking for? What are we needing? And, well, two different things. What are we looking for, and what are we needing, really? Lisa, you want to lay in?
Sure. I think it's a really important point to look at what is the electorate, the public, looking for, and whether we're really looking for what we need. I think that we all have a fantasy, and I think that the media participates in this, I apologize if I offend anybody, of a kind of regressed fantasy of the perfect ultimate father figure who knows everything, who's in charge of everything, who is killer, high testosterone, powerful, alpha male, but at the same time totally in control of their impulses, never going to cheat on their wife, not having any kind of appetitive drive problems. They're in control. And they're completely compassionate. And you can't get this all in one person. So I think we have to recognize that the kind of traits it takes to be a good politician sometimes put them at risk for other behavior. So we were hearing about the dopamine system and the serotonin system and testosterone, but another way of looking at personality traits that seems to have a very, very strong genetic basis is the distinction between introversion and extroversion. And extroverts tend to be highly social, gregarious, have a lot of initiative, a lot of self-confidence, but they run the risk of being reckless and having insufficient caution. Introverts tend to be more thoughtful, more introspective, more careful, but run the risk of being overly socially withdrawn, overly socially anxious, and also overly cautious. And you can make the argument that actually both Obama and Mitt Romney have introverted traits because they are both very family-oriented and kind of careful and methodical, data-driven, both of them. I think a good contrast would be Bill Clinton, who's extremely extroverted, but who would sometimes run into trouble because he was reckless, at least in his personal life.
We know.
Yeah. So I think that politicians tend to be extroverted. Sometimes they're introverted. But the introverts will have difficulty sometimes reaching out as much, being as outgoing enough, communicating enough. The extroverts will sometimes have trouble with controlling a competitive drive. So I think we need to keep in mind as a public that you can't have everything. And that we're electing human beings, we're all adults, and we're not going to be electing parents. And I think that the public needs to take more responsibility for having more realistic sense. People shouldn't, I don't believe, shouldn't lose their job because they're unfaithful to their wife. I mean, you wouldn't fire anybody else from any other job. We have to sort of expect human frailties and then evaluate these frailties based on whether it really impacts the job.
I wonder if there is any way, and I'll turn to you, Ashley, in the minute we have left, is how do we assess who we trust?
That's a very good question. I'd love to give you a very quick answer to that. Clearly, we haven't yet developed the measures that Helen's been looking into to assess that in an instant, I think. But I think we tend to look for people who have similarities to ourselves. Might be a broad, generalized way of approaching this. So we'll tend to look for people who have similar personality traits to ourselves in order that we may then trust them, because in some way we feel we can identify with that person and what they hold dear to them. So it's no surprise when you look at the left and the right of politics that personality traits do differ slightly, but then you'll find voters tending to vote for people who perceive politicians as similar to themselves in terms of those personality traits. So we make some pretty broad generalizations as human beings. It kind of helps with survival and making those quick decisions. But in politics, yes, I think Lisa's right. It's very hard to have everything as a result of that. It depends what's most important to you at a given time. And they do say, you know, cometh the hour, cometh the... Well, we tend to have presidents who are men, don't we? Why is that? Why aren't we having more women as presidents?
Yeah,
there's another question there.
Yeah, and maybe that question in about 4 years or 8 years will never be asked again. We'll have that answer because it will be changed. Well, I want to thank both of you so much for joining us. I think it was an important, certainly an enlightening show. My guests have been Ashley Weinberg. He's the author of The Psychology of Politicians, and he's a fellow of the Higher Education Academy at the University of Salford in Manchester. Lisa Cohen is a psychologist and associate professor of clinical psychiatry at Beth Israel Medical Center at Albert Einstein College of Medicine in New York. And we also heard from Helen Fisher, a biological anthropologist at Rutgers, and her article is in Newsweek. It's called What's in a Politician's Brain? Well, next week we're going to hear from the author of Woofs to the Wise about friendship and difficult conversations. Well, the engineer for today's show has been Al Banks. Elizabeth Perez-Loon is our executive producer of audio content. Emily Haas is our volunteer. Joshua Rafman's our intern. Mike and Scott is our executive producer. Jennifer Lynn is our producer. Great job today. And me, I'm Dan Gottlieb. Good luck, my friend.